The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A big week for markets as September comes to a close. Listeners' questions answered. Announcing the Investology launch party. And our guest, Grant Williams, the second part of our discussion with the founders of Real Vision. All this and much more on episode number 527 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I am back and I have power. Yes, after 9 days of no power, finally, FPNL decided that, well, we were worthy of maybe getting some of our electricity back. And finally, we have it. It is amazing how much I missed my electricity. I know that sounds kind of silly, but until you don't have it, you really sometimes don't appreciate it. And the oppressive heat and humidity down here that we had to deal with. And of course, all of the just, the lack of refrigeration and freezer and the ability to have a cool house without all that, just that heat sitting right on you all the time is amazing. Now, fortunately, the good news is, while I did sleep in my house a couple of nights and I said, that's it, I'm not having this anymore. I can't do this. This is way too hot. Trying to sleep in 90-degree weather with 90% humidity, or though somewhere around there, we went to some friend's house and kind of bounced around night by night. I had my bag with me packed, my four-day bag, and I just schlepped it around and went to various friends' houses and family, and that was nice. They took us in and provided and helped us out, just like we would do, of course, for anybody else. It seems that maybe only a few hundred people now in Florida on the East Coast don't have power, so hopefully they'll get that back very soon. There's obviously were some very significant damage to the various, whether it's the power lines or transformers or whatever else is going on there with those areas that just had some problems getting their power back. FBNL had promised that we'd get our power back by, I think it was the 17th or the 16th, and then took a few extra days. And anyway, it was about 3 days after the promise date that we actually got our power back. And the worst was that we actually got power back for about 3 minutes at the house. The office, we had power. We had generators here. But at the house, we didn't have a generator, and the power came on for about 3 or 4 minutes, and I had my neighbors texting me, hey, power's back on. I was all happy, and then all of a sudden, they text me back a few minutes later, power's off. I mean, what a letdown. You know, getting all excited that, I'll be able to sleep in my bed tonight. How great is that? But didn't turn out that way. Anyway, everything is fine down here. Hopefully, wherever you are, whether it's in the Florida region that got just totally obliterated and damaged by Hurricane Irma, or in Texas in those areas, or Puerto Rico, or in the islands, wherever you're listening, hopefully your situation is getting resolved a bit. And I'm hoping that this was a front-end loaded storm season, and that's it, because I can't take any more of this. This is kind of rough. But let's talk about what's going on. We know that September is coming to a close very soon. This is the last week coming up for markets in the month of September 2017. And with that, we have the usual cast of economic news that comes out and reports that come out towards the end. We saw that the Fed did, in fact, hold tight to no rate increase at this time in their last meeting. And during the press conference, there was a discussion about how they would start to unwind their balance sheet. And the big question is going to be, will they actually be successful in doing so? Because they hedged the discussion pretty significantly. Well, you know, if the economics need us to, we could buy more and we could slow down and we could sell more or we could just let it roll off. And, you know, it was back and forth. They didn't want to commit to any one particular thing, although they did talk about a commitment, at least in the beginning here, where they would start to roll off their bonds that they hold and shrink their balance sheet. We'll see how that plays out. The dollar rallied on that pretty significantly. And the euro came in and the yen came in, and there was a definite move towards a higher dollar. One of the things that you have to watch for now is the reaction to any of the ETFs that you hold in foreign currencies. We've talked about this so many times on this show, how you have to take a have an understanding, I guess I would say, that, you know, if you're investing in a Mexican ETF or a Japanese ETF of equities, many of those are held in the local currency. And as such, you have to make sure that that currency that you have is going to be protected in times when there is a change that is significant with the dollar. So far this year, you've had about an anywhere from an 8 to a 10% tailwind in those particular ETFs that are priced in non-dollar denominated currencies. And you have to wonder whether or not it's time to take some of that off the table, not to mention how the rising dollar could in fact impact other areas like emerging markets, Japan, et cetera, you know, what's happening around the world. So just be aware of all that that's going on. All right, let's talk about a couple of things first before we get to our guest. And I want to mention that we are going to answer some of the listener questions that you sent in. You can always go over to Ask Andrew section on thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just ask me a question at any time, anything you have on your mind, or comments or discussion about the show. But first, let's get to some of the economics that are going to be coming in the next few days. So what do we have? Monday, nothing of substance that's going to be coming out, except for the reverberations, of course, with North Korea. A little rocket man is being touted by the president. And of course, the deranged president is being touted by the counterparty there in North Korea, talking about how the bombs are going to be and missiles are going to be definitely coming to the U.S. very soon. Who knows what amount of rhetoric this is, and who knows what kind of fear this will put into markets. But at the current time, that seems to be ratcheting up a little bit. And isn't it amazing how it always seems to happen on weekends? I don't know what that's about. It's like everybody's just hanging out during the week and they're like, let's start talking about North Korea. It's Friday. I don't know if there's some cocktails involved or what's going on, but it seems that the weekends are the time that always we have this ramp up of rhetoric. And of course, we have a lot to see talking about political issues with regard to the healthcare bill that has about 7 or 8 days until it actually has the limitation on the special vote that can happen. So these are things that are going to be coming up towards the end of this week. It should be an interesting week. But we have on Tuesday the consumer confidence and the Case-Shiller home price index. Case-Shiller has been kind of moving up at about 5.5 to 5.8% per month on a year-over-year basis for the 20 city. And that's been good. We've seen a continuation of housing prices recover and actually in some areas surpass significantly from the highs they had back in the mid-2000s. New home sales will be out at 10 o'clock Eastern time on Tuesday as well. Expectations for a run rate of about 565,000. That's probably been brought down a little bit because some of the recent numbers on new homes and existing were a little bit lighter than expected in terms of the run rates. Nothing bad, nothing significant. We'll see if this is because of maybe the slightly concern of what happened during the hurricanes. And it's not related to consumer confidence because we know we've seen that at about the 120 level, which is extremely high. And both the University of Michigan also, which will be coming out by the end of the week, is still at about 95. So confidence is high. Investor confidence is high. So we're not seeing any kind of blips there. That's good to see. Now, on Wednesday, we're going to see durable goods. Now, if you remember, we saw that durable goods last month when it came out for the previous month, which was July. This is the August reporting date. But in July, we saw a big drop in durable goods orders, about a 6.9% drop. Now we're looking for about a 1% gain when we strip out transportation, looking for about a 0.3% gain. Very volatile number, that durable goods. Important, but volatile. You want to take notice if there is any significant move that is a continuation off of the previous. So in other words, if we have consecutive months that are negative or consecutive months that are positive. But if we have 1 month down a bit, that may be just airplane orders or maybe some other large purchase orders. It's possible that it's just a wonky number. You know, it's just noisy, just noisy. Then we have pending home sales coming out also on Wednesday. Not the most important. Looking for about a -1.5%. And of course, on Wednesday, crude inventories will be coming out at 10:30 in the morning. On Thursday, we're going to see the third estimate of the GDP. Looking for about 3% is where it's been. On Friday, I think these are kind of important. Something that I'm going to be paying attention to, which is personal income, personal spending. We've seen this has been just nowhere. We've seen that personal income's been on the rise. Personal spending's been just doing nothing. Even though we have consumer confidence high, it seems like consumers are just not spending a lot, at least, or they're spending on lower priced items, possibly. Just not putting a lot out of pocket. We also have PCE prices, which are important into the inflation calculations by the Fed. We did see that PPI did jump up a bit last month. And then we have the Chicago PMI and Michigan sentiment. The final for September, again, looking at about 95 overall. The other thing I want to mention here is that this is important. And if you haven't seen this announcement yet, this is something that you want to pay attention to, is that we're having the Investology launch party. Yay. finally, after months of testing, after about a year of putting this together, Investology is now open. There's a lot of people that have come in already and we're managing money and it's working. It's going, it's happening. It's pretty exciting. This is the advisor crafted and technology enhanced platform that we put out. Minimum investment is $10,000. And we did this because a lot of you had asked for this kind of program. Now we took the back end guts of a robo investor and robo advisor kind of back end. And then we put an overlay on top of that, the best of what we could find of how to actually manage money. We didn't want to have the same thing, these robos, these set it and forget it concepts. We didn't want to have the idea that it's just a rotation and a reallocation process on a regular basis, whether it's, I don't know, monthly, weekly, quarterly, annually. We wanted to have a little bit more inside of there to really have a very robust and a very significant management of your money program that can actually give you what you're looking for. And we're going to discuss in this program, it's going to be happening on Thursday. It's a webinar. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Right on the top of this episode, you'll see a little button that says the announcement of the launch party. Click there, get your reservation. I think we have room for another, 25 or 30 people in the webinar, and then we'll close it. But basically, we're going to be talking about the dynamically managed part of the process, the real diversification, the real difference between these so-called robo-advisors and really what they give you, even though it's cheap, but what are they really giving you? And how it could be, as I say, the rise of potentially destructive financial advice. We're going to talk about the access to high barrier to entry mutual funds, non-proprietary funds, and the combination of passive and active management inside of this alternative equity exposure, the regular portfolio rebalancing that we do in this, and how to set it up, how to get involved in it. It's really going to be kind of a fully loaded discussion about what this is all about. So you don't want to miss this. You can go over to either investology.com or thedisciplinedinvestor.com and see what that's all about. There's buttons and links on how to register. You need to register, though. You have to register. It's going to be Thursday, 1 p.m. This coming Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. So make sure to do that. Investology with an E. E-N-V-E-S-T-O-L-O-G-Y. Investology.com is where it's all at. So check it out. I think you're really going to like that. It's pretty cool. A good diversifier, if nothing else. A really good diversifier, if nothing else, to add to your construct of your portfolio. You know, if you're a day trader, if you're a swing trader, if you're a buy and holder, if you like stocks, if you only like mutual funds, whatever it is, it's a really good way to diversify a portfolio as an addition onto what you have already. So pretty cool. As I mentioned, we're going to have some listener questions answered. at the end of the show after we talk with our guest and with some closing remarks as well. So make sure to stay tuned to that. But right now, let's get right down to our discussion. This is the second part of our discussion with our guest from Real Vision, one of the founders. So let's get right to it. And we're talking with Grant Williams today, and this is a second part of a two-part discussion with the co-founders of Real Vision. Remember last week we talked with Raul Paul, and this week, Grant Williams. So Grant, how are you?
I'm great, Andrew. How you doing?
Great. Let me set this up. So according to what I found out about you and what I know about you, you've been in the business for about 30 years or so, you old man. And you've held some senior positions at a variety of investment banks and brokers and around the world, some big names like UBS, Bank of America, Credit Suisse, and all that. You also have, back in 2009, started a little thing called Things That Make You Go, Hmm, which is a pretty popular and widely read financial publication. And you're also a senior manager at investment firm in Singapore, and you do a lot of things and a lot of speaking and all that. Did I get it all right?
That's well. I will tell you that I'm wearing every one of those 30 plus years like a glove. So that to me is by far the most important bit.
The rest of
it is pretty accurate.
As long as you distribute it well.
Well, look, it's distributed evenly, but you wouldn't know that to look at me.
So I had a lot of things that I wanted to talk to you about because I read a variety of your newsletters, and but some of the things that you also been talking about I found very interesting. For example, I would love to get your take on this discussion about the U.S. Treasury potentially draining liquidity. Now, I want to set this up right and tee this up for the discussion because when we think about draining liquidity out of markets and out of the financial markets, we think about the Fed, right? You know, they put in liquidity, they take out liquidity through various operations. They do it through rate tightening or loosening and quantitative easing and reverse repos and all these kind of things that go on behind the scenes. But you're talking about the U.S. Treasury here that is looking to possibly look to drain about $350 billion of liquidity from the markets over the next 4 or 5 months. Tell me about this.
Well, this is the famous unwind of the Fed's balance sheet. This is what they've been trying to telegraph for a long, long time now, and the belief that if we talk about it for long enough, to use Janet Yellen's words, it'll be like washing paint dry. And no one's going to be surprised by it. And it'll all go along smoothly, which is great. You know, and actually, I have to take my hat off to Ben Bernanke, which is not someone I often do. But he said something about QE, which really struck me. He said, the trouble with QE is it works in practice, but it doesn't work in theory. And what's happened is they've been fortunate enough that as they've piled all this liquidity into the markets, we haven't seen the things that people feared, which was rampant inflation, and people worried about all this liquidity sending prices skyrocketing. But what's actually happened is we've seen asset price inflation, dramatic asset price inflation, whether it's in stock markets or bond markets or real estate or all kinds of real assets. Prices are at such elevated levels, and the reason they didn't get this massive groundswell of what people recognize as inflation in terms of rising prices is that all this money, all this liquidity went to the people who already own assets. They own stocks, they own real estate, they own bonds. And those people have a very low propensity to spend money. They're savers. They have their assets and they're happy to accumulate them. So with that being said, as they've gone through this process for almost a decade now, we haven't had any obvious negative side effects because to central bank governors who are looking for stability, rising markets aren't seen as a negative outcome. The problem comes when you try and reverse this trade. And if you think you can pile this money into the market with no negative side effects and have asset price inflation and stock markets, bond markets at all-time highs, and then do the reverse operation and not have the reverse effect, I think you're dreaming. It doesn't matter how carefully you prime the market to be ready for it. It's going to be very real to people very, very soon. And I think what we saw this week with the Fed's meeting, and they've now put a date on this, they've put a time on it, it's going to start in October. I think now if markets haven't actually put in their highs, we're not going to see them go an awful lot higher from here. And what happens in the rest of this year, moving into early 2018, I think is going to be both very instrumental and potentially reintroduce the notion of volatility, which seems to have been missing for a couple of years now.
So let me throw this out at you because it's interesting. What could happen here from what you're saying? What you're saying is that we didn't get inflation as expected. in any, I mean, we got some inflation, but we didn't get the big inflation that was expected because the money that was utilized, the money that was injected into the economy in some form or another through quantitative easing and low interest rates was done in such a way that it benefited only the people that don't really spend. Now, that's what you said. Now, what's interesting is, if you think about it for a second, the converse of that is, if in fact the Fed starts raising rates and it doesn't tamp down inflation, right, it keeps it the same as it is, then what they could do is think that they are able to increase interest rates even higher because it won't have that effect. In other words, there's no, if what they're doing is not having an effect, then therefore it's not going to have an effect on the other side. But what may happen is that that excessive amount of liquidity is going to be drained from the same places, therefore causing more of a stock market issue than an economic downturn, which maybe the stock market will react to the economy will react to the markets. But what you're saying is it could be a very interesting surprise for everybody that that's dealing with this.
Well, to me, it won't be a surprise. To me, I think this is rampant asset price inflation. If you have a Federal Reserve that is not pumping in liquidity and is actually draining liquidity, then these assets are overvalued. And markets tend to correct those sort of overvaluations once they realize and they see them for what they are. And I think that the day the Fed start physically unwinding that balance sheet and prove to the world that that is the business they're in now, things have to be revalued. And the thing that worries me is that these things tend to get valued quickly and suddenly. And when they're as overvalued as they are, there's a big air pocket between here and fair value. You know, just looking at the growth, and I've spoken about this recently. If you look at the last 10 years, we've averaged 1.3% GDP growth over the last 10 years. That's less than half of the weakest of the previous five decades. Now, if you are to think that maybe 2% growth in the US, for example, is actually going to be okay going forwards, which it might well be, if the market comes to the conclusion after 10 years of 1.37% growth or whatever it is, that, you know, 2 is going to be decent from now on. As soon as you make that assumption, you join those dots together, you look at equity markets, they are valued excessively for a world of 2% growth. So we've lived in a world, as I called it in a recent presentation I gave, a world of pure imagination, like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And if reality returns and the Fed reversing course and starting to shrink their balance sheet may be what triggers the return of reality. Well, if reality returns to central banking, then reality has to return to markets. And currently, with bond markets at 5,000-year highs, volatility at all-time lows, and equity markets at all-time highs, those three things do not sit well with reality. So, you know, I worry that they all return to fair value at the same time, and that would be some upheaval, the like of which we haven't seen since 2008.
So if the Fed quantitative easing, from most people's minds that thought it was going to go on forever, is the everlasting gobstopper, what you're saying here is that when we find out that the everlasting gobstopper will actually not be everlasting is when things go awry.
Well, not only that, but you could choke on it. You know, that's the problem. You know, that becomes the issue.
Right.
And the Fed have been very careful in trying to prepare people for this. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to start it soon. What's going to be perhaps the most telling moment is if markets do wobble, whether the Fed blink or not. And I just think they're going to have to blink because the consequences of all these assets going back to fair value simultaneously is the kind of event that they have gone out of their way to avoid for the last 30, 40 years. And I think they'll have to do it again.
I just find it really interesting that there is so much consensus about the fact that, you know, bond prices are at a reasonable or relative high, and it's kind of crazy where things are. But then we know that there is this massive search for yield. No matter who puts out what piece of crap bond, it's just gobbled up instantaneously because pension funds and all this need this extra money. Then on top of it, you have sovereign wealth funds that think that they can have 75%, or even pension funds that are, you know, sovereign pension funds that think that they could just pump their stock holdings up to some ungodly amount and they'll be fine forever. And all of us thinking, you know what, that's going to go on infinitum. And, everything's going to be fine because with the amount of excess equity exposure that has been taken by many sovereigns, which have a tremendous amount of money, right? I mean, huge arsenal of money. You just wonder Well, what happens next? Now, this is just another way of artificially pumping money into the markets by governments. Does that mean that retirement plans just go kaplooey?
Well, look, think of it this way. The fact that high-yield bonds are trading inside treasuries, if you'd said that at any point in financial history, people would look to you like you're a crazy person, but there it is. Now, let's suppose high yield is trading at all-time highs. Treasuries are within spitting distance of all-time highs. Now, let's suppose if the central banks are going to raise interest rates again, let's say you could get 3% interest and not have to own an asset at 5,000-year highs to get it. You know, people are going to sell those bonds at their 5,000-year highs and put their money into CDs and money market accounts where they can get the same yield with zero risk. And so that's where the math doesn't work. And the more you raise interest rates, the less attractive you make all these assets look at these crazy levels. And so at some point, there's a tipping point. I don't know exactly where it is. None of us do, but we'll see it. There's a point where the math doesn't work anymore, and markets will ultimately go to where they get the best guaranteed returns. And markets tend to shy away from overvalued assets. And any asset that's trading at a 5,000-year high, by definition, has never been more overvalued in 5,000 years. So you know, why would you own those? And I just think it's that realization that on the one hand, the Fed wants to ease this balance sheet down and drain liquidity, and they want to raise interest rates. But by doing that, they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. And it's just a matter of when.
And one of the things, the side effects of this could be, we haven't really seen a lot of this yet, even with the Fed raising rates, what, three or four times at this, was it three times at this point? Again, not off the bottom of zero. I mean, we're not talking about very high. We're still at the bottom here. But one of the side effects theoretically could have been a rise in the dollar. But the dollar has been down. It's down about 10% year to date. By the way, do you have any thoughts on why the dollar is down 10% year to date? I mean, it's kind of a quandary.
Well, not so much. And I think, you know, we had that tremendous run in the back half of 2014 through 2015 and into 2016. The dollar had a tremendously strong run during a time when everybody was trying to talk down the dollar, whether it's Trump or Clinton at the time or Obama. I mean, nobody wants a strong dollar. It's a painful thing, not just for America, but for the world. So a strong dollar is really not in many people's best interest. Certainly hurts Asia, certainly hurts commodity producers. So the victims of a strong dollar are scattered all across the globe. So it's not really been a surprise to me. I kind of turned bearish on the dollar about 16 months ago. But now I think with the Fed doing what they're doing and seeming determined to go through with it, and if you look at the positioning of the dollar, I mean, there are so many shorts out there now, it does feel as though we're at a point where you could see a rally. But to me, it's a counter-trend rally. I think the dollar goes lower. I think it goes lower because people want it to go lower and they will try and force it to go lower. But you may be in for a short-term bounce, and it could be a pretty hard bounce over the next sort of 3 months or so. But I think the long-term trend of the dollar is lower.
I mean, and one of the things I'll tell you, what we did was just last week, we have some exposure to international bonds that were unhedged. And that has done very well over the last, let's call it 8 months, 9 months. We actually swapped that just last week to the dollar hedged version of the international bond exposure position, feeling that, you know what, it may be time, as you mentioned, for either a counter trend bounce or at least some kind of move the other direction, because it's been kind of a train in one direction for such a long time.
Yeah, it has. I mean, the beauty of currencies is that when they trend, they tend to trend for a long time and go further than people think. So once you identify those trends, they're good to ride. You get choppy periods when the trends reverse, and you have to try and figure out, as I said, whether it is a counter trend rally or if we've seen a secular change. But to me, I think any bounce we see in the dollar at this point in time, to me, is either a short term bounce driven by positioning, or it's a short squeeze because the Fed is going to drain liquidity. But again, it's just one of those additional reasons why the Fed is so constrained, is that if they do start draining dollar liquidity and cause a short squeeze in the dollar market, again, they're going to really need to step in and try and stop that, because the amount of dollar borrowing, you know, there's $10 trillion outstanding in global dollar borrowings. And now the BIS have come out in the last week and said they found another $14 trillion. In footnotes of balance sheets around the world. You know, how you can miss $14 trillion of outstanding dollar liabilities.
Rounding issue.
Exactly right. But you know, the numbers we're talking about here in this age of central bank money printing, the numbers get really scary really fast. And in some ways that kind of helps them, because this law of large numbers where people really can't get their heads around $1 trillion, and so they kind of think it doesn't really matter because it's such a big problem, it'll get sorted out somehow. That kind of works until it doesn't. And you know, my worry is that as this unwind begins, that's the point where it stops working. And with the central banks relying more and more on their credibility and the faith that markets place in them to manage this. And bear in mind, the Fed have never got anything right. I mean, they've overshot and undershot. They've hiked the economy into recession just about every time we've seen a recession. Their forecasting record is abysmal. And yet markets still assume that they can...
Isn't that funny?
Stick what has to... Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, because... But wait. You said they didn't get anything right. Let's just mention one thing. While they don't get it right in the end, in between, it's fun.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's right. But to close your eyes and do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do because you're riding the tailwind the central banks have created, to any kind of value investor, it's just anathema, but you kind of have to do it. You're absolutely right.
So let's kind of quickly go to this leads us right into the potential for something you recently wrote about, the potential for some VIX-related funds and ETFs to go poof in a day. The idea that when you kind of dug into some of the prospectuses of the inverse VIX funds, that things like SVXY or XIV. Tell me, you found something really interesting about what could happen potentially.
Well, we've seen, ironically, in a world which, in my lifetime, I don't remember ever being or seeming more volatile. We've got market volatility as measured by the VIX at all-time lows. We were trading with a 9 handle on the VIX. And that's because largely this era of central bank tranquility has led to the short VIX trade being the best performing strategy in the world, mm-hmm. bar none. So as that's happened, it's attracted more people to try and short the VIX. The Sharpe ratio is off the charts. I mean, people are making a lot of money being short VIX. And so the trend followers jump in. So you've just got this relentless selling of volatility, which is fine. You know, it works until it doesn't. And so if you look at the positioning, if you look at the size of these, you look at the flows into them, if we get a move from 9 to 16, which, don't forget, the VIX used to average 12. This a move to 16 is by no means 2008 levels, and we got up to 90 back then. You see that kind of move, and it's going to evaporate an awful lot of money. And because there's so much of this money is just trend following that's jumped into these strategies, once the momentum turns the other way and they have to sell, there are not going to be many buyers of short volatility products with volatility spiking. It's such a problem to try and sell an anti-fear instrument when people are afraid, because you know some people get greedy, but everybody gets afraid. So when fear takes over the markets, the herd gets much bigger. You know, the greedy herd are much smaller than the fearful herd. So you know that's why a few people ride stock market bubbles to the top. But everybody panics when things start to go the other way. And that shift mm-hmm. from greed to fear is always a really, really dodgy time to be invested.
I mean, in these days, you see that the VIX does go up and it goes, let's call it to 14 or 15. But then immediately after a day, we've seen many days when the markets are down and the VIX comes in even further. Yeah. And that may have to do with, there's other things that it has to do with, obviously. It has to do with the timing of when that happens. It could be the particular roll of the VIX from one month to the next, and the contango versus backwardization, all this good stuff that goes into this whole VIX thing. But the truth of the matter is that if that whole, if it switches in terms of the pricing of the future versus the short term, that could end up being a problem. And if it lasts more than a couple of days and actually starts to show a little bit more stability to the upside towards the, listen, we all talk about reversion to the mean, but no. I've seen people say that right now, the only reason the VIX is at, let's call it 10 or approximately, and not 6, is because there is some uncertainty due to the current geopolitical circumstance related to a lot of the legislation unknowns, et cetera, in the U.S. In other words, they're saying that take that out of the equation. And if we got some resolution on some of this, we could see this fix at 6, which would be pretty unbelievable. I guess it has to do with the current mentality of markets, which is, you know, just let's, if it's down in the morning, let's buy it. If it's up, okay, we'll sell a little bit, but not much. We'll kind of move it back up. And I think the other thing is that this whole idea of ETF passive investing, where you just kind of just put my money in on a daily, weekly, monthly basis automatically, and things will be fine because you know what? Even back to 2008 and before, if I just sat still and didn't do anything, I'm better off. And that's kind of...
I think that's very true. I think it's very, very true. And people do think that way. There's one kind of caveat to that right now, and that's that we are at the beginning of the baby boomer retirement cycle. And so what's happened is you have the biggest generation in history to retire have now started retiring. And at a point in time where they should have their maximum allocation to bonds, they have been forced by zero interest rates to have their maximum allocation to equities. And so the sheer force that you're going to see of selling should we see a market downturn is going to just swamp the bids. And again, when you get the passive investments, which have really mushroomed in this era of low volatility and central bank liquidity provision, you know, the ETF universe has grown 6, 7, 8 times since 2009. So really these things, which are trend following, have only really been tested and only really grown during a rising market. And obviously, if you're a trend following instrument in a rising market, that's great. But what we haven't seen yet is what happens when the trend is lower, which you know, will happen. Markets are cyclical. There will be a period where the trend is lower. And so what happens when you've got 5,000 ETFs when the world is trending low and they're all trying to sell at the same time passively without any regard for price, but they are following the trend is lower. We don't know is a simple answer. Mm-hmm. But if you flip it around, you look at what's happened on the way up, and then you overlay something which I've lost count. I bore myself to death at this, but I keep saying to people, you know, any hour of the day or night, I can find you an offer. And you might not like the offer. It might be up 50%, but somebody will make you an offer 24 hours a day mm-hmm. in any stock you want. Mm-hmm. But when markets are going down, the bid is very often zero. People don't catch falling knives. They don't step in the way to make you a bid 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you know, all these flash crashes we've seen, to me, these are just simply dress rehearsals for a downtrending market when passive price insensitive vehicles just start hitting sell. If the bid stack's thin, they sell. They just sell the bid right the way through down to wherever they go. And instead of it just being a one-off flash crash, when you've got another ETF provider jumping on the back of it, the price will stay down there until more bids come in. So I think we could see tremendous dislocations. And that feeds on itself because people who've been invested in the market see volatility rise, see big price swings, and they get nervous. And right now, in an era where markets seemingly on the face of it are not as unvolatile as they've been in living memory, people are complacent. And so the mere reintroduction of some uncertainty into these markets, I think, could have a vastly magnified effect.
You know, for those of you that are listening that are saying, oh, this guy is pretty negative, I want to kind of just step in for a second and say that, you know what, if you're kind of getting a little bit like, oh, I don't want to listen to this and it's really negative and it really is, oh my, how could he be saying these kind of things? I only want to hear the positive. I want to remind you that there are, first of all, multiple sides, multiple opinions. Of course, we know that. But the other thing is there's a little bit of reality in here that you need to be aware of and positioned in a way, at least mentally, to be able to react if need be, if any of these things actually start to creep in and form a picture of reality in the markets, because you don't want to be caught in having a confirmation bias only on one side. Try to have a very open opinion of what could be, maybe not, I'm not saying this being scared, fearful or anything like that, but be at least, have yourself in a sense of reality. And listening to something like this, to the wisdom of what Grant is talking about, I think gives us a very good insight into some of the things that are out there that are percolating that may become a problem. If they're not, okay, so be it. But if they do, at least you know about it. How's that sound?
Yeah, Andrew, that's such an important point for people to understand. I'm not saying this stuff's going to happen tomorrow. What I'm saying is this is a possibility. And everybody that has a dollar invested in the markets, you can't just leave it there and ignore it. I just think it's time to look through your portfolio, understand what you own, understand the potential risks, and then say to yourself, if you're happy staying invested here, that's fine.
Yep.
But if you've had a great run since 2009, which anyone that's been invested in the markets had an unbelievable stock market run against the most anemic recovery in the last 100 years, you're playing with house chips at the moment. So just take a look at your positions, take a look at your profits, and just decide, am I happy with what I own? And if you are, that's great. But if you're not, or you think the risk is getting bigger, you know, the number one thing to avoid when you invest is big drawdowns. And so if you can step out of the way of those, you will do very, very well over time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the risk is elevated that you might see a big drawdown. So it's risk management, pure and simple. Take a look at the outcomes and make sure you're happy with how you're positioned.
Absolutely. Grant Williams, co-founder of Real Vision and author of Things That Make You Go Hum and Charts That Make You Go Hum, which we didn't talk about a few of these. We'll put links on where you could find dividends and buybacks as a percent of operating earnings. Really cool chart, as well as the explosion in cryptocurrencies. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It's a great pleasure.
Very cool discussion. I like that. Let's get to some listener questions, as I had promised. I'll just mention this again, that if you do want to ask a question, and sometimes I answer some of these questions directly in an email. Some of them are a little bit more complicated and really can't answer them fully on the show. Some of them can be, but you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the little button that says Ask Andrew. A little form will come up and you can just fill it out and we'll do our best to either answer you directly through email or on the show. The first one comes from Adam R. And he says, hey, Andrew. He says, love the show. I'm based in the UK, over in Wales, actually. And I've been a listener for quite some time. Be great if you could answer my question on the podcast. So I'm 43 years old and a long-term value investor in individual stocks and ETFs. I've been trying to learn about level two to gain better entry points. But do you think that level two is necessary for a value investor looking to hold stocks for 10 years or more? Look forward to your advice. Thanks. All right. So a quick explanation of what level two is. So when you look at the stocks and you're looking at prices, you look at the bid and the ask on a stock or an ETF, and you see the bid, you see the ask. That's level one. Basically, it takes the best price and the tightest price between the bid and the ask, and it shows you that's the bid and the ask of a stock or an ETF or something traded on the markets. Now, a level two is next level. It shows you not only the first and best pricing, but it also shows you who's behind it. It shows you all the different players on all the different platforms, whether it's ARCA or whether it's NYSC, whether it's on NASDAQ, on OTC, or on Amex, whatever it is, wherever they're trading and whatever the particular buyer is, it shows you a depth of where the buys are. So when you ask the question, Adam, that, okay, you're a value investor long-term, and you say that you hold stocks for 10 years or more, I say to you, I don't know what the difference is of, and reason would be to utilize a level two, because level two is really looking for the depth for buying and seeing what the depth is, especially if you want to do day trading, scalp trading, or swing trading. If you're buying and holding something for a long-term period of time, why in the world would you really, I mean, I don't know why you'd care about that. So you get maybe a 10 cent or a 5 cent better or worse trade. What's the difference? If you think about it, it really doesn't matter. Over a 10-year period, what is that going to amount to? So I don't really think it's necessary. I don't think it's necessary at all. But it's good to know what it does. It's really good education to understand it. But for long-term holding, I don't see where there's a real significant benefit to that. So hopefully that answers that question. Let's see what else we got here. we got a question from Craig. He says, what do you think the fundamental fair value for Bitcoin is? In my eyes, it is zero. Thanks. Well, the fundamental value of Bitcoin, I don't know if we can actually look at this on a fundamental basis because there are no real earnings behind it. There is no value behind it, such as gold and silver. Now, if you think about it for a second, when you look at gold and silver, there could be even a little bit more fundamental value. You could look at the actual physical prospect of the actual gold and what it's used for. You could do that to a degree, but you can't hold Bitcoin. You can't actually see it physically. You can't use it in any physical dimension. It's really only good for a payment system and possibly only the value of what others can value it at and what really what the intrinsic value of it is in terms of using it for future opportunities. Now, zero, I don't know about that. Is it overvalued at this point? Possibly. At this point, we don't really have a lot of players that are utilizing it as much as you would see to use it as a, quote, currency. There are some. And they're growing every day. You're seeing more and more places taking Bitcoin or altcoins for various payment processes. Not only the dark web, not only the unsavory and unscrupulous type of drugs and sex and all the things that you think about when you deal with cryptocurrencies, but there is, I think, a value there. I'm not sure how to actually pin it on it, just like you can't pin it on other, you know, many other things. It's an intrinsic value, not a fundamental value. Now we got a question here from a little while ago, but it talks about the Plunge Protection Team. It's from Sal S. He says, hey, Andrew, thanks for talking about the Plunge Protection Team on one of your latest podcasts. It's funny because I was just about to email you and ask about the Plunge Protection Team and also about the BOJ ramping up the USD JPY or the cross of the yen and the dollar to keep metals down, which it turns keeps the SPY flat or fixed for the day. I was also curious, the Bank of Japan, when they can't devalue the yen, keeping the VIX down in order to keep the SPY flat or fixed. In other words, the S&P isn't allowed to go down hard. I noticed how we recently had big sell-offs in the NASDAQ and tech names while the S&P finished flat or just barely down. Does this make the markets artificial? For example, Janet Yellen plus ECB president plus BOJ president equals fake markets. I don't know. Sal, is it fake markets? It is what it is today, right? Now, if the markets move up 10% and we believe it's all fluff, let's just really pretend for a second, Sal, that it's just all BS. There's nothing to this. But markets move up 10%. And let's say 2 months later, they move back down the 10%. So, we could ring the bell and say, oh, we were right. Yeah, that was BS. That was being held up only by one of these things that you mentioned here. In the meantime, though, Sal, whatever you want to say, it did move up. Did you participate? Or are you so worried about this just falling out of bed to zero? If, in fact, we know that the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, is buying equities in their markets and around the world, if we know that sovereign wealth funds are busy buying things until their money runs out, if we know that retail investors are also very busy buying things, whether or not they view the fundamental value as important in the PE and the PEG ratios and the underlying book values as something that they find to be something they look at in order to value the stocks, in other words, they don't care. If we know there's liquidity right now, what's happening? What's happening is all these players that don't care, maybe, are saying, well, I'll just ride it until it seems like the ride is over. So don't get caught up too much in this. You know, obviously be aware that this is all going on. But if you get too caught up in it, you're just going to be paralyzed and not do anything, right? Michael B., he writes me. He wrote me a little while ago, and he says, a general question, why is my inbox overloaded with people wanting to give me a presentation on their systems that ends up costing me $5,000, but today I can have for, let's say, $800? A short but incomplete list includes, and he gives me a list of all these different people. I must have responded to one of these videos in the past. That's why I'm getting all these emails, but here's my question. Are any of these legitimate, or are they all actually effectively scams? He says, number two, why are all these people wanting to sell their system? Number three, if someone wanted to accept their offer, what would you do? Would you recommend, watch out for, example, and it gives me a few examples. In particular, I wonder about some of these guys' services. Their literature is good. I talk with the people there, but in this particular one, which I'm not going to mention, but I demanded not a recounting of their wins only, but a complete history of their trades for the last year. The return was netted about 10%, and then they declined. So basically, let me give you my thoughts on this. There are some very worthwhile newsletters, services, systems, platforms out there. Now, first of all, I would venture to say that the really inexpensive ones are probably worth it, what they're worth. They get in a lot of people with a lot of big, flashy, hey, 10,000% gains over the year. I mean, you get paid. You think somebody's going to sell that for $19.95 a month or a year? The probability is the more expensive they are to a degree, the more they have something to actually give you, because they're not going to give away their systems for free. Now, I'm not telling you to go out and buy the most expensive one, but I would say that if they make their living by looking for and doing this on the basis that they are really trying to sell what we call buy-side research, where you're paying for them, so there's no bias here, and they're not giving you too many flashy news items, they're not hitting, listen, if they're hitting you every single day, they have a massive marketing budget. They probably have a team of people there that are figuring out ways to get into your email box, to call you on the phone, to send you a letter in the mail. And they probably also have an entire marketing team dedicated to figuring out what those fancy headlines are and the graphics and the one-pagers are. I would say that you have to be careful of some of these, no question about it. Now, in terms of systems, that's a little bit different. For example, we write systems for TradeStation. We have a company called Trigger Charts. You know about this. I've told you about this before, everybody. Now, why do we sell? We sell for $149 per month. That was a fair price for the algorithm that we built that gives you really good entry, exit, support, resistance, market profiles, and all this other stuff. Then we have some other ones that we sell for $79 a month, which is basically an oscillator that we calculate that gives you a really good trend following swing trading, entry and exit point, overbought, oversold. But those are out there that are just giving you maybe signals. Maybe there's some good ones out there. I found some very good ones out there that give you some really unbiased trading alerts, chat rooms, information, reports, research, not cheap, $200 a month, $300 a month, $500 a month. But again, just use your best judgment. If they're really flashy and sending you massive amounts of emails, and you know they have a lot of claims that they have out there, maybe it's more marketing than anything else. This one comes in from, I hope that answered that question. I don't know. You have to use your own judgment on that. There's so many out there. And anyway, next question comes from GOG. He says, hey, Andrew, love the podcast. I live in the UK. I was concerned to hear from Eric Townsend that in the event of a large market sell-off, ETFs can lose significantly more than the underlying assets they track. I could see how this could occur with a synthetic ETF, but wouldn't a physical ETF only fall to a similar amount of the shares, assets, or the NAV in the index tracked? I've always assumed that physical ETFs act like closed-end funds, such as the UK Investment Trust. A further explanation would be appreciated. Cheers. Well, here's the problem. As we just talked about and heard about from our guest on this show, Grant had talked about how when there aren't people buying, there are no bids. And we've seen this in flash crashes and in big downturns that happen very quickly. Sometimes what happens is that while an ETF, yes, does have a net asset value, and maybe it is right on with the underlying valuation, what happens is that ETFs are still traded. So if you have a thinly traded ETF that while the NAV, the net asset value, may be the same value as the underlying assets, what happens if bids disappear because it's thinly traded and there's nothing being traded? It could theoretically fall well below, I mean, significantly below the net asset value. Now, will that stay forever? We've seen this. In the flash crash, for example, we saw some of these ETFs traded 50% lower than the value day before when the markets were only down 8 or 9%. Now, does it make for good bargain hunting? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. However, we also saw in the flash crash that a lot of those trades were canceled by the NYSE, et cetera, and the markets. So there is this potential for these ETFs to lose value significantly and for the bids to go away, essentially, for a period of time. The question is, how long? That's the big question. Do I think that this would happen and be a situation in the SPY ETF? or in the Qs. I mean, there could be a momentary drop in the value because there are no bidders on it. But I would think that cooler heads will prevail and you'll come back. And what will happen is you'll get that bid back. It could be at a discount. We've seen this in closed-end funds. Closed-end funds oftentimes will trade at a significant discount to NAV. There's liquidity issues. There's concerns about internal liquidity issues. There's concerns about withdrawals and what that would do to the actual underlying assets, which have to be sold off. And of course, those buyers and sellers that are making the bid ask. So I don't think it's going to be necessarily zero, but it can be. So it could do that. It is possible. Anyway, that ends this little section on some of the Ask Andrew questions that you had sent in. Again, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and put in your own question and we'll do our best to answer it. I'll mention just in closing, once again, push you to make sure to sign up for the Investology launch party. And I had mentioned that is happening on Thursday this week coming up. Thursday this week coming up on the 28th of September, 1 p.m. You have to register. You must register. So make sure to click that link and register for the webinar. It's on the front page of the Disciplined Investor or on Investology or on the show notes of this episode. You'll find it anywhere. Anyway, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here each and every week, getting the great feedback and comments on Twitter. You can follow me, Andrew Horowitz, and all the great emails that you send me on a regular basis. Please continue to do so. This is not only a one-sided discussion, it's a two-sided back and forth conversation, not only with the guests, but with the audience and you and me. And we make it all happen each and every week. Thanks again. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.